Hello and welcome to the Walk Podcast. I'm David Tiltman, Chief Content Officer at Walk. And today we are joined by Mark Ritson, internationally recognized marketing expert, consultant, and longtime columnist. And he's probably most famous for his mini MBA training programs. Now, in probably his most prestigious appearance to date, he is here on the Walk Podcast.
It's the big time.
Yeah, it really is. And we're doing a video episode. So if that is your cup of tea, then please check out the video version of this episode on Walk's YouTube account or on walk.com.
Can we add, though, David, for those listening on audio only, I look sensational, very akin to Brad Pitt.
You do. I mean, you know, how you've managed to look this good on the Thursday of Cannes is
remarkable.
I'm dying.
Just think Clooney mixed with Pitt. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? That's really where it's at, for, you know, obviously.
Now, we're also doing something a little bit different on this one, too. We've reached out to the Walk community on LinkedIn, our Cannes strategist event, to get people to submit some questions. We want to sort of throw something, some stuff from the community to you. And this will be our sort of first Ask Me Anything episode. But Mark, welcome back to the Walk Podcast.
Good to see you, David.
Now, you're not just back on the Walk Podcast, you're back in Cannes.
For the second time, repeat offender.
Yes, and the gag I made last night was, this is a great example of attitude change following behaviour change.
Very good.
So just tell me, I'm sure our audience knows, you were very mean about Cannes for many years.
I took the piss out of it for about 12 years.
Yes.
That's true.
Yes, and then you came last year. So are you a convert?
It might be going that way. I've got to be honest with you. I found last year, and I think we talked about it last year, I did find that I came with purely with the intent of going, I've been once, therefore I can now smoke it for the rest of my life, having experienced it. But I got here, and yeah, I mean, the two things that struck me, I have to be honest, and it strikes me again this year, it's the only place where the Americans and the Europeans, I mean, obviously the other nationalities too, but the big American, big European marketers are all in attendance. And you just don't get that anywhere else. And then in the alleyways around the Croisette, there is a lot of deals being done. And I speak partly mostly as a business person now, in the sense that we've done a lot of business here this week. And you know, there's been some great sessions, but I have to say there's been some very great deals. And, you know, they're the kind of deals that we could fly to Switzerland and to Chicago and try and get those deals. But being able to walk around a corner, have a cappuccino and do the deal and move on to the next one is incredibly efficient and positive. So I have to admit painfully that it is a very, very valuable 3 or 4 days.
I'm very pleased. So
I give it to you. And you were telling me this for years, Mr. Yeah. Tiltman, so I'm now fully seeding. You were correct.
Thank you. I'll just take that clip. Now, you mentioned the Americans. You have been very mean about American marketers.
I think accurate was the word I would use. But I've seen American marketing go backwards now for a good 10 years. In my opinion, it's too soft. I think the data bears that out. I think they're less effective. Generally, obviously there are many exceptions, but there is a sense that the America I studied in the 80s and 90s, where they were so far ahead of the Europeans, it was like a different world. It's now not only reached parity, but you look around the world, who are the experts in marketing, branding, attention? The Americans are very, very notably absent from that. Yeah, it's bizarre. And I can't explain it, but I think it's time to go in there with the international literature, with the work that's being so well done, you know, in the rest of the world, and bring it into the Americas, because they, by and large, don't know it, you know?
It's really interesting. I know this is, we talked a little bit about this last year, because I mean, I have a slightly different angle on it, but what's been really interesting
for
us.
What's your take on it, David? Go on, it'll be interesting.
Well, I think my take is it's just an enormous market. So you have the very best, and then you have a very long tail. And that exists everywhere. But you do have some insanely effective.
From P&G down, you've still got the great ones, right? Interesting.
But we released a report earlier this year, The Multiplier Effect, which
who could have missed it, David? It was a spanking.
It's been all over Cannes as well, and not just.
Oh,
in
it's
our
had
sessions.
An impact, right?
Yeah.
It does have an impact.
Yeah, but we deliberately did that with a US audience in mind. It was US data. It was
bringing them the information
exactly, and And I think, I mean, just I guess this sort of echoing your point, that we just found the appetite for that was huge.
And the surprise at the content, which, you know, I'm not criticizing the report at all. It's fantastic. It really was brilliantly reworking with data much of what we've known, right?
Yeah.
But doing it beautifully and elegantly. But I think the surprise you saw out of the American company is like, this is amazing. What's this? And it's like, no, this is the songbook that we've all been singing for 10 years, beautifully done. But I couldn't have been happier when I saw the impact it had in the States, because we, you know, we want a strong American marketing scene, you know, and I think that the multiplier effect was a brilliant example of international going back into the US.
Let's talk a little bit about what you're talking about in Cannes this year. It's a study you've done with Effie, our partners at Effie, and with System One. Just tell us a little bit about the headlines from that.
So it's really Andrew Tindall's hard work, and I want to make sure Andrew gets lots of credit. So Andrew brought together System One's enormous database of creative measurement, you know, real-time measurement of emotion, of fluency, of, you know, how is the ad working? Got hold of the Effie database, thanks to Tracy and the team there. And again, in both cases, we're talking about 15 years worth of data, 1,300 campaigns. And then what he essentially did was he looked at what parts of the creative are driving brand and business effect. Because we're all familiar with Paul Dyson's famous league table.
Yeah.
Creative is, you know, a 12 times multiplier in theory. My point is, it's never been very clear. So how do I get the 12, not the one? And so what I wanted to do with the data is say, what are the key applicable lessons that get you a 10 or 11 times multiplier and not a one or a two. And we've got the data and the answers, and the answers are three things. You absolutely need to use emotion, and the data is incredibly clear, and not just mawkish emotion. You know, you can scare your client, you know.
It's not just about making them cry or
that's right, the broader
mistake we made for a few years.
So yeah, absolutely. An emotional feeling. It's about codification fluency. It sounds obvious, but most of the ads that we see in Cannes aren't so clearly branded for the consumer. And then finally, the big one is about time. So you need, and the data could not be more clear, you need to run the ads for 2 or 3 years. And we are nonsensically short term. And I don't mean that in the sort of performance marketing sense. It's astonishingly clear that it takes 2 to 3 years for a campaign, even for an ad, to have its full effect. And we're pulling them, you know, with it in less than 6 months, which is ridiculous, as the data demonstrates. And the multiplier effect of emotion, codification, and time is astonishingly powerful from the data, with business effects, not just brand effects. So for me, that was the big job. And we use ads, lion-winning ads, to demonstrate, here's what it looks like and here's what you should do. And here's how they test it, you know? So I couldn't make it more practical. I think it's a great session. And it's down to Tindall's data. I mean, it was messy data, I would say that, but it was good data. And so I think it's a very important session, yeah.
And the data is, I believe it's from US, UK, Ireland.
You're right.
So we've got that US angle
again. It's got the US data in it. It's got international. It's got UK and Ireland. You know, the great thing about a data set which has, you know, 12,000 examples is, when we slice and dice it, it's still a meaningful...
So I've got a good number.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess a somewhat cheeky question, but last year creativity wasn't enough.
It's still not enough.
This year it's about the creative dividend.
It's still not enough. So creativity is not enough on its own. But if you want to zoom into that corner of the puzzle, this is how to get the most from that little piece. You know what I mean? We have to remember all the other pieces. Pricing and strategy, and on we go. And product, not the least. But if we want to say creativity within communications is a multiplier, and I'm slightly skeptical of the 12 times, but let's go with it. How do we get more from that? It's me trying my best to be advertising centric and creative centric, yeah. Neither of which are of great interest to me in a normal day, as you know.
Okay. I'm just going to jump into some of our sort of questions that have been submitted, because actually talking about creativity, and indeed the point you made about consistency, how do we do that in a world where that is not just fragmented, it's sort of atomized in terms of media consumption? And we've had a session about lots of littles from Grace Kite and Tom Roach and JJ Heelan. We've also had you know, creators all over Cannes this year. So
yeah,
I think Tom Roach made the sort of point that there's this real tension between what the data is telling us, this sort of consistency over time, consistency as a brand, and what's actually happening in the market, where we're having to create more and more types of asset to fuel just like the relentless pace of,
yes,
of the modern media environment. What's your take on that? What's your sort of, you know, way through all of that?
It came up a lot this week. I work with a couple of brands here in these workshops that can do. And that's exactly the question a couple of them asked me. I really, first of all, I think creating content because we want to create content has always been a silly thing, and it goes on, right? There is, however, a reason why we need lots of short, tactical, moving, agile content for all kinds of different reasons. For me, it's about moving out of the middle. So if you think about traditional 20th century advertising with all those silly segments with pictures, and that was a sort of middle ground where I'm going to build my brand to four or five different segments in different ways. And as we now increasingly know, it didn't ever really work. The answer, I think, is to bifurcate it. And so on the one end, we still need that big branding, global, consistent, multi-year emotional piece.
Mm.
Yeah. But on the other side of it, we then need our performance marketing, not just to be ROI obsessed, but we need it to be incredibly targeted, agile, shifting, moving, content-based. And I think between those two extremes, you have your distinctive brand assets that unite the two together. And I think the brands that are doing that are now able to do both well.
Mm.
We get into trouble when we sort of move into that middle and try and have agile branded multi-content when we should be running 2-3 year strong campaigns, which have lots of, you know, moving activations that are, you know, that have the ability to move and be different. And I tell you, Field and Burnett were onto this years and years ago. I remember them explaining to me a decade ago, a segment can be a bunch of people coming out of a tube station at a certain time.
Mm.
And that's, I remember them saying that to me. It doesn't have to be this big psychographic attitudinal cluster. It's just a certain group at a certain time in a certain place that we want to activate using our brand. Multiply that by 1,000, and I think you have what it should look like. And that's where I disagree with Ehrenberg Bass, because we need that capability to slice and dice that performance market while acknowledging that they have been right all along, that absolutely, if you've got the budget, you should build your brand to everyone in the category.
And it's an interesting point you make a moment ago, because it echoes a comment. I interviewed Les Binet and Sarah Carter earlier in the week. And one of the points they made was, we're asking them about, you know, how things have changed over their career. And we're talking about the idea of what is a campaign. And one of the points they made was that a campaign used to be something that you thought about over many different executions
and a lot
of time. But now it's come to mean this extremely short sort of, you know, brief window of time. And
the campaign, you know, absolutely was invented because it was like a Roman campaign, a 4-year plan using multiple weapons and multiple tactical conceits, right? That's why we called it a campaign 70 or 80 years ago. You can't have a campaign which is a 3-week foray into the Super Bowl and out again. That's not a campaign. That's just a bit of advertising.
It's an ad.
And what it proves is, by the way, I show a Super Bowl ad as an example of what's wrong with a lot of the work at the moment. The Super Bowl advertising is phenomenally important, but if it's the only thing you do each year, it's exactly wrong. It should be part of a campaign. And when it's not, we're down that short-term path.
A related question from Callum McCann. Can creators and influencers actually build brands?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, again, back to your campaign point, they're one of the many tools that we can utilize in our campaign. The problem with many of these creators and the problem with marketing is most of them have no training in marketing. So they're not aware of the power of integrated marketing communications. They're not aware of the difference in tactics and strategy. So when they hear that they can build a brand for a client, they assume it's just what they will do on their own. And it's like, no, that's not how this works. You're a tactic and you fall in line with the following other tactics. You know what I mean? They don't see that. They're looking at it from their point of view. You know?
And the way budgets are structured in companies often doesn't help that, because the creator budget is separate to the...
That's right.
To
the, and they don't see the big picture, right? Yeah.
Okay, let's get to another question. So which smaller brand has surprised you by doing diagnosis, strategy, and then tactics the best in the past few years? And that's come from John Swatton.
It's always nice. I mean, often my experience is you go in with a client, and a big client with famous brands, and you discover none of that stuff's there. I mean, the way I train marketers is to do the triptych in that sequence, as John is suggesting, you know. Diagnose the market, including segmentation. Make your strategy choices, targeting, position, objective, and then tactical execution, not just advertising, product, price, distribution. It's often amazing when you go into most big marketing operations that none of that structure is in place. It's mostly tactics. So it's always nice when you go in to a smaller brand and occasionally discover someone's doing it well. Not to any acclaim, not for any awards. They're just doing their marketing onions properly. And I guess the best example would be Robbie, who's the CMO down at Mona. So Mona's the Museum of New Art in Tasmania. Mm-hmm. But when you scratch the surface and start chatting with him, what's delightful is you discover that he's absolutely applied the right process to this very creative, very notorious institution, which looks like it's just all being done like from a mad, random point of view. But the minute you sort of pull back the sheet, here's Robbie's data, and here's his ethnography, and here's a little bit of conjoint, right? Here's a very clear target who we want, here's who we don't want, here's the positioning right in the middle, beautifully done. Here's the objectives for next year. And he was doing things like, they have a great ad campaign, which you see at the airport in Hobart, which is based purely on this clear positioning and clear objectives for the brand. And it's there when you sort of get your luggage in Hobart Airport, and it's all the negative reviews that they've received about Mona with a photograph of someone unhappy, right? I mean, for a long time, one of their big pieces was a shitting machine. So they created quite a complex machine from a famous European artist, which replicated the human defecation process. You'd put some food in it, and about 6 hours later, it just produced shit on the floor, right? And that's very Mona, right? So he has loads of quotes from people saying, yeah, great, I traveled for 4 hours to look at a machine shit itself, right? That's a giant billboard outside Hobart Airport. And that comes right out of Robbie's data saying, we don't necessarily want you to like it, but we want you to know you have to come to see if you like it, you know? Good brand tracking, good work on pricing. You wouldn't see any of it, but it's there. And I love those moments when you see a guy you've taught a few years before. You know, it's one thing, you know, oh, I like the class. It's another when they're doing it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It really is a different... My highlight day, for example, is I work with Simplot, who own like John West and other great brands in Australia. I train all their brand managers on the mini MBA. And then once a year, I go and review their brand plans. And their boss is also like, oh, Mark, it's good of you to come in. And I say, this is the best day of my year, because I sit there and watch people I've trained do it, usually quite well. And there's you know, as a teacher, there is no greater moment.
Fulfilling,
I mean, one of my annoyances with Erenburg Bass is they're supposed to be teachers too, but they get all pissed off when people use their theories and apply them. And it's like, you know, I get it. Science is falsificationism. So you have to disprove the previous work. And they've done that very well. But science is also, once you've got my tentative theory, I love that. And I'm the generosity of science is you're going to use it. And that's fantastic. You know what I mean? It doesn't have to be so negative at the back end, in my opinion. I think they spoil their legacy a bit because of that.
Let's segue on to a Byron Sharp related.
Let's get to the Dark Lord of penetration. He's always here. He's here in Cannes, right? He is wandering the corridors.
Yes, his shadow has not.
He has no
darkened.
Shadow, David. Have you not noticed?
Well, he's going to need one here. It's flaming boiling. But, right. This is from Don Boyd at Kantar. I put that in for good reason. What are your thoughts on Byron Sharp's recent inflammatory comments on pricing power? And to give viewers and listeners some context, he recently went after some Kantar comments on LinkedIn and was very sort of mean about the sort of what Cantor was saying about pricing power, which is as a topic is something that has excited a lot of researchers and marketers over the last couple of years, because, you know, as we've talked about before, it starts to join the dots between concepts like brand building and not just sales, but actual profit and bottom line, not just top line. So I know you're familiar with the comments, but he basically, I think, to paraphrase, he sort of argues that pricing power is a sort of artificial construct, and people's willingness to pay premiums is just based on the product, really, and not on some.
Yeah, and that's obviously horseshit. And I'm not saying the Kantar work is perfect. I mean, let's rewind all the way back. So on my journey through marketing, which is maybe different from Byron's, what have I learned? I've learned that it's all about profit. You know, I'm very proud of our top line revenue at Mini MBA, but I'm much prouder of my operating margin and total profit. I've also learned that the single best way to drive profit is with price. It's not with cost. It's not with more sales. And the Wharton research, which goes back 25 years, is very clear on this. They've analyzed thousands of brands. A small increase in price has a dramatic impact on corporate profitability. And then let's step one more step back, which is where the Kantar work sits. How do we get greater prices? Well, there's two things. We have to drive price insensitivity, and then we have to have the guts and the skill to price accordingly and take that margin. I think when Aaron Bobas get involved in this discussion, they need to be very careful, because first of all, they're wrong, but second, they should be exploring it with the rest of the marketing community. I mean, you know, Kantar are doing a pretty good job on this. You know, is that measure of price insensitivity, the elasticity stuff, is it actually the price that you can then charge? No, it's not. There's more pricing research to be done, right? A good conjoint will then rapidly demonstrate. Mm. And I think the thing that's missing from Ehrenberg Bass's knowledge of this area is that there's a difference between price and pricing. Yeah, between theory and the real world. Yes, there is a price that a company charges, but there is also pricing, which is the manner in which we do research into it, set the right price, and communicate the price. And I think it's one of the most exciting areas of marketing. And I think the thing missing from Byron's cognizance here is just how badly pricing is done. Because he speaks as if there's some kind of existing optimum pricing already in place. I can certainly attest to the fact there is not, and that the vast majority of companies are pricing using two ridiculous pieces of research. Number one, the cost of goods, and number two, the prices set by my competitors. Neither of which have much to do with what the price should be. It should, of course, be based on what the target customer is prepared to pay. But we enter the world of dogma here because, of course, Ehrenberg Bass don't believe in differentiation, or certainly at an advanced level. And if you don't believe in differentiation, you don't believe in affecting price elasticities and price premium. And that's where this all comes from. It comes from dogma. It doesn't come from empirical analysis. And that's a shame.
Right. Aware of time, we've still got a few more questions to get through. This one's from Anant Dapur. With the rash of mergers and demise of once legendary brands such as JWT, Y&R, etc., what's your diagnosis of the agency industry's own positioning?
I don't know. I mean, they've been very poorly run for a long time, okay? Very poorly branded, very poorly promoted, very poorly structured in terms of, you know, you can't have a thin sliver of old white men running it and then this giant demographic gap down to a team. And as these very good marketers and advertisers reach their 40s, they're deemed to be too expensive, right? You can't run businesses like that. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, I suspect we will see a massive transition in the businesses. And I feel for the people in the industry because it really is now a time where if you have a passion for advertising, which many people do, many of us did when we were younger, you wouldn't really go into the industry now because it's so wobbly as to what will happen next and where you might go. You know, and whatever the change is, it's big, and a lot of it is I think is self-created.
Well, I mean, you mentioned changing the market. So we've got, inevitably, we've got an AI question. This one comes from Nick Myers. It's very broad. What's your view on how AI will impact the marketing mix? There are lots of people out there wondering what this means for them, whether they're on the creative side or the research side. I know you've looked at this in a number of different ways. I know you've been very supportive of things like synthetic data, for example. Yeah, yeah. So where do you see these changes at the moment, and where do you see their sort of biggest impact in sort of marketing and advertising?
Well, I should get a lot more credit than anyone else, first of all. So as you know, I've spent 15 years correctly pointing out that NFTs and 3D printing and the metaverse were all a big bunch of cock, right? I wrote columns on it at the time. I pointed out that Facebook's Meta stuff was nonsense. That I think I called, is it NFPs or NFT?
NFTs, no, NFTs.
NFTs were an idiot magnet.
NFPs, not for profits. I think we...
Oh, they're good. Let's make that clear. Yes. The NFTs were an idiot magnet.
Yeah.
And for marketers that didn't have training and didn't really know what they're doing, they're all going to make one, right? And I think I was proved 100% correct. In contrast, Gary Vee, a man who I like very much, but I think has very little knowledge of marketing, was on every boat sailing it from the front. So Gary Vee was always going to tell you AI is going to change the world. And a chorus of people that sell the pornography of change were behind him. When someone like me, who's old and fat and cynical and has a proven record of saying it's bullshit, says, no, this is going to change everything, I get 10 points, you know what I mean, over 1 point. You should listen to me, right? How will it change? Well, the second point is it will do it much slower than we're currently thinking. So, you know, I call it the pornography of change because it's very easy to do a LinkedIn post, get carried away with it without any data. And before you get to paragraph 3, we've got flying cars and everyone's going to live on space in the moon.
Where is the flying car? I mean, honestly.
Where is it? You know?
I've been waiting for that for a long time.
So my point is it will come a little bit slower than we think. I think the 30s are obviously the era. It will not come from marketers sitting in their underpants working out what good prompts are, right? And I wish they would stop, right? It's pathetic, it's not helpful, and it's really making LinkedIn extraordinarily useless, right? So getting all those people to stop talking about, I've written a great prompt for blah, 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 this is not what AI will be. Yeah, it will be agentic, it will be organized at a macro scale, and when it finally comes, yes, it will change many things. What will it change? Synthetic research is already clearly here to stay. I have a stake in a company, Evidenza, so I have to declare that. So it's become a genuine, AI is already playing a huge role in diagnosis and that whole data world. It already clearly is also a tactical application. These ads are getting better. Very quickly, it's clear we're going to be seeing these generated ads. I personally believe we'll always have human-created big brand ads.
Mm.
But in the world of these smaller tactical promotional vehicles that we spoke about earlier, the ability to generate this content using AI
quickly
and learning and changing is a very exciting project. Yeah. I think it's down that end that we'll see that. The bit that interests me is in the middle, which is the strategy piece. We're working on it a lot. I think we're about a year away from a full brand planning AI system that isn't just, you know, ChatGPT, give me a marketing plan and it gives you some SWOT and all that bullshit, but is built from intricate amounts of synthetic data, planned in a very human way from, you know, my and other people's experience of building great brand plans. And crucially, the other point is, if you look at what, I mean, I would say to you right now, we're about 75% of the way of building this, you know, proper brand planning system. So you literally put in the name of your brand, and within about an hour and a half, you've got a brand plan, which is more advanced than anything even P&G or Diageo would produce. So the point isn't, though, a human brand manager is going to be probably less good than an AI brand plan. Because part of the AI brand planning processes will then run 400,000 iterations of the brand plan, modifying various variables. So it's actually the story of a human brand manager versus 400,000 AI brand plans with the best one of all, the thing that you've got to compare to. Mm. I think that's 1 to 2 years away, and by the 30s becomes the dominant way we develop strategy.
Does that then potentially, assuming there are still humans involved, open up potentially a world where there are, the default brand plan is much better?
Yeah, I think that's true. And of course, given that it's capitalism and competition, it becomes a case of who's got the better engine, right? Mm. The interesting part when you actually do this practically is we need a manual override. So each brand manager will want to go, okay, that's what the computer says, but what if I rewind back and I change that target, right? There's still a little bit of intervention there. But yeah, I think this will help particularly mid-sized companies. I mean, look at synthetic data, right? It instantly allows B2B companies mid-size for the first time to actually gather a representative sample of CTOs or CEOs and survey them, right? Because it's all synthetic.
The alternative is often not. It's that or a big research budget. It's that or no research budget.
That's absolutely it, David. I mean, you know, it's all very well we talk about, you know, doing diagnosis. But if you drop, in B2B especially, if you drop one level down, SME and above level, I mean, I've had this conversation literally 1,000 times. A well-trained B2B marketing director says, but I can't do any of that because I haven't got the data. I can't segment. I can't build funnels. I can't set objectives. I can't do PMAPs. And now with synthetic data, the answer is you can, right? And it may not be perfect, but it's a lot better than nothing, you know? So yeah, I believe that AI planning system is the area where you really could get a competitive advantage, but also you're about to get proper brand plans. I mean, think about it. Instantaneously, we can segment the market. We can choose the optimum targets. We can choose the optimum leverage points for the objectives. We can work out the optimum positioning. We can do situational pricing analysis for optimum price. We can suggest product development techniques. We can create the creative brief for the agency or the ads if you want us to, right? Boom. You and I both know. I mean, there's an old study that was, if you put AI up against a cancer surgeon, AI is now beating cancer surgeons in spotting breast cancer. That's a very well-trained cancer surgeon, right? We're talking about AI versus marketing managers that 3 times out of 4 don't have any training in marketing and 5 times out of 10 don't have any data. It's a very poor industry, right? So yeah, if we can automate it, I think we're on the brink of something which is very, very interesting for the industry. But I don't think it's 26. I don't think it's 27. I think it's as we go into the 30s that we'll see this giant revolution.
Yeah. Question more about on the client side. So this one comes from Jess Messenger. So can you give us a quick fire take on the many brand acquisitions thus far this year? For example, Versace Prada, Poppy PepsiCo, Rode Beauty, Elf Beauty, Deliveroo, DoorDash. And I guess to sort of build on that, is that indicative that you know, the way to growth now is sort of acquisition, you know, a whole co sort of replacing innovation with acquisition?
I think there is a moment here. There's also a moment of, thanks to Mr. Trump, there is a moment of liberal economics in which those kinds of big deals are more likely to go through. I think there's a moment where we've been on it for a while where less brands is more. And you see that in companies like Coca-Cola just killing brands. But you also see it when you see these big mega deals going on, right? There, you know, let's go back to our, you know, our famous league table of advertising profitability. We all know the biggest driver of advertising profitability is brand size. So if you can put two brands together in categories like banking or food delivery, where advertising is a huge part of the overall cost structure, that's an amazing advantage to suddenly, you know, 1 and 1 really does equal 3. So I think, yeah, we'll see more and more of it. I think it's a natural process in categories where the governments involved will allow it to happen. And it makes perfect sense, by the way, if you can get away with it.
One more question and then we'll wrap up with a final thing. So this one's from Kathy King. I know what your view on purpose is, but what's your view on purpose-driven campaigns in 2025?
Look, there's two caveats, and then let's get the chainsaw out, right? The caveat, there are some genuinely purpose-driven brands that it isn't a one rule for all. And we talk about Ben and Jerry's, and we, you know, yeah, there are some brands that are genuinely built from purpose. Let's put them to one side. There's also the caveat where, like Pret-a-Manger, there are companies that do purposeful things without any expectation of return. Pret-a-Manger give the sandwiches away to the homeless people in the cities they're in because they don't want to add to food waste, and it's a bloody good thing to do. It ain't going to make them more money. It ain't going to make them more successful. It won't win them more customers. They do it because they're good people, and it's a shame to throw food away when people are hungry, yeah? So purpose is do it for the sake of good. And so where I really lose my mind, and let's give credit now to Byron as well, because we've been on the same page, the pair of us, for 10 years, is this belief somehow that purpose is driving commercial success. And the challenge I always give to all marketers is to stop being a marketer, is as they're listening to this podcast, is turn around, go to your refrigerator, be a consumer for a minute, not a marketer at Cannes. Open your refrigerator and gaze upon your purchases and ask a very difficult question. How many of these things did I buy because of the purpose of the company behind the product? And the answer in every case is none. Yeah.
And what do you make, I guess, in particularly in that US example of the change in tone since the start of the Trump administration that may affect how people sort of see this sort of tactic?
I think that's fair. I think it's part of it. I think we'd also got to the point where, you know, we'd been drinking the Kool-Aid for so long, it started to become untrendy. I think the data started to emerge that it wasn't working. Companies began to realize it was nonsense. But yeah, the Trumpiness also did contribute to it as well. I did a podcast a couple of months ago with two very senior CMOs from very big brands in the States, and they eloquently described their purpose-based agendas, and I thought they were very, very impressive. What I questioned with both of them was if it was going to have more commercial impact than doing other stuff. And my point was, don't do it. Do it for the sake of good. Do it because it's the right thing to do. That's not a bad message. But don't confuse doing things because it is the right thing to do with doing them for commercial reasons. And we come back to that central thing. You mentioned Sarah Carter earlier. Her greatest of many great quotes is the idea that every marketer should have that post-it note that says the customer doesn't give a shit. Customers don't care. They really don't care about any of this. They say they care, but they don't. And the proof is in their purchases, you know? So for me, I think we've reached the end of that period, and I'm very grateful we have. I really smell in the air a return to much more prosaic positioning. Yeah, I think positioning is the biggest shit show in the history of marketing. I think if you look at the top 100 companies, most of them have too much nonsensical, overstated positioning, decks, triangles, and wheels. I see positioning very simply as a single page that has your distinctive assets and the thing or things you want the consumer to think when she thinks of your brand. And I'm right. And everyone else with these brand books and overstated nonsense is getting in the way of success. And Wael's here from Nestle. Kit Kat remains the best positioned brand in the world because they do it on a page. They've got a ridiculously tight one attribute positioning about breaks. They've got four distinctive assets and they haven't changed it or their agency in 29 years.
Yeah, significant. I think that Mark Pritchard talked a lot this week about getting back to basics. And yes, it really was back to basics.
And he walked back from purpose a couple of years ago here, if you remember. He was very clear about, you know, he had the causality of it. It was like, we're doing good and we're selling brands. He's like, actually, we're selling brands and we're trying to do good. And that's a very important reversal, he said. And this year, yeah, back to basics, because basics are all right. But here's my problem. Most marketers don't know what the basics are. I'm tired of people talking about marketers need to speak the language of the boardroom. No, they don't. First, they need to speak the language of marketing, and they don't know it. They don't know it, David. Honestly, it's not good enough to have 75% of the marketing industry untrained in marketing. It's bullshit, you know? So before they learn the language of the boardroom, before they learn the language of AI, just try and understand marketing. Because when you train a marketer, what happens is this is a remarkable thing where they go, oh my God, I'm more confident, I'm more capable. It's like, yeah, isn't it amazing? When you're trained in something, everything gets easier and you get better, you know? And I just don't get the disconnect that we have. So if we go back to basics, that's great. Let's make sure everyone knows what the basics are, because right now, 3/4 of marketers don't.
Final question from Matt Ehlers. What do you believe that most people don't?
I think English wine will always be shit, irrespective of what happens to the climate. I'm not buying it for a second.
Product problem or a brand problem?
It's a savoir-faire problem, right? So, yeah, the brand will be an issue for a while. You can't take that skill. You know, the Australians have done a pretty good job. South Africa's done a pretty good job. They're still nowhere near the French, right? The climate's going to change, obviously, but there's a long way to go. And I differ with certain people in my organization who love English wine. I think it's all pants, and it'll stay pants.
Well, on that bombshell, we will wrap it up. Mark Ritson, thank you so much for joining on the Walk podcast. And thank you to the Walk community Hivemind for asking all those incredibly smart questions. If you've enjoyed this podcast, be sure to tap follow on your favorite podcast platform. We'll be back soon with more fantastic interviews, research, and much, much more. Thanks for listening, or indeed for watching.